The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 26/May 3, 2021. The heading is Climate is Everything, How the Pandemic Can Lead Us to a Better, Greener World. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with Time in very large capital block letters in white, superimposed upon a grayish white background. It looks like a milky, cloudy sky, but it has the outline of the world's continents lying upon it, upon this non-topographical map. The outline of the continents is in brownish gray. It looks like a forest on a mountainside that's been burned to a crisp, because there are flames sprouting up from these dense brownish patterns. One can see some hands even in this photo with long sticks who are igniting the flames on each of the continents, including the large island of Australia. A caption reads, artist Red Hong Yi created this image out of 50,000 matchsticks to represent how the climate crisis connects us all. Red Hong Yi created that artwork, and it was photographed for the cover of Time by Annis Lin. Another photograph just inside on one of the front pages of the magazine depicts a large locker or refrigerator space with very large refrigerators. They're not double wide, but they're large, perhaps like a home freezer would be. They're all in white. The interior of the building in which they are set is stainless steel. It's all shiny and dull stainless steel. The ceiling, the walls, the doors, the floors. And there's an individual working in this room dressed in blue, wearing a face mask. And the door to one of these large refrigerator or freezer type objects is open. The caption reads, once bottled, the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine is stored at minus 82 degrees centigrade, which equals minus 116 degrees Fahrenheit, at a filling and labeling facility in Halle, Germany. And that photograph is by Luca Locatelli for Time. For the record, the first page, that you will hear what monsters might be lurking there. Sounds like a title of a children's book. What Monsters Might Be Lurking There, said by Chris Pauly, P-O-L-L-Y, Fermilab physicist, speaking at an April 7 news conference on experiments with magnetic fields that suggest tiny particles known as muons, M-U-O-N-S, do not always obey known laws of physics. A discovery scientists believe could change our understanding of the evolution of our universe. I've ran from myself for a long time. I've hated myself for a long time. A statement by Colton Underwood, former star of ABC's The Bachelor, in an April 14 interview on Good Morning America, during which he came out as gay. 3,400. The approximate age of a golden city unearthed by archaeologists in Egypt, which experts April 8 described as the most significant find since the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb, 3,400 years old. Sedition came from within and without our one house. King Abdullah II of Jordan, in an April 7 statement responding to reports of an alleged royal coup attempt. Even if I have to lose the crown for the values I stand for, I believe I'm serving the purpose Mrs. World stands for. Caroline Jury, J-U-R-I-E, Mrs. World, 2020, in an April 10 apology video. Following an incident at the Mrs. Sri Lanka pageant, where she snatched the crown from the winner, who she claimed had violated rules mandating that contestants be married. 11-1 odds of a first-place finish by Manila Times and jockey Rachel Blackmore, who became the first woman to win the UK's Grand National Horse Race, April 10. Every award is meaningful, but this one, especially recognized by British people, known as very snobbish people, I am very, very privileged. A statement by Yu Jong Yun, Y-O-U-N, in an acceptance speech April 11, after winning the Best Supporting Actress Award at the 2021 BAFTAs for her role in Minari. Good news of the week, the United Arab Emirates announced engineer Noura Al-Matrouchi, 27, as its first female astronaut, April 10. From the brief section, the brief opener, Nation. A wave of new bills threatens trans youth, by Raisa Bruner. It is a spring evening in Arkansas, and Joanna Brandt just closed down her boutique. She and her son Dylan, a 15-year-old with a thatch of floppy blonde hair, are tired. It's not the pandemic. Joanna has actually enjoyed remote schooling her two kids. And it's not the management of Dylan's weekly hormone therapy treatments, injections he has learned to administer himself over the past 8 months. No, it is that they, like most of the U.S.'s transgender community and its advocates, are tired. Because in recent months, Arkansas and a growing number of other states have been stripping trans youth like Dylan of their rights. The one thing that's helping me become who I want to be and has made me as happy as I am and as confident as I am, they're taking that away without a second thought, Dylan says. HB 1570, which passed in Arkansas April 6, after state lawmakers overrode a gubernatorial veto, is the first bill in the U.S. that effectively bars trans youth from transitioning. Specifically, it bans gender-affirming care, making it illegal for clinicians to provide puberty blockers and hormone therapy. It is the third anti-trans bill passed this spring in Arkansas alone. The state's legislature is now considering two more. Over 100 anti-trans bills in 33 states are being considered in legislative sessions, according to the Human Rights Campaign, the highest number in any year on record. Some seek to bar trans women and girls from competing on sports teams consistent with their gender identity. Some restrict opportunities for medical care or criminalize it. Some give care providers the right to deny a trans patient treatment on the basis of moral or religious grounds. They share a common theme, attempts to limit and minimize the potential for trans youth to live normal lives, and backing by conservative groups seeking a new hot-button issue around which to rally. The ACLU is planning to sue in Arkansas, hoping to make an example of this kind of legislation. Meanwhile, the bills keep coming. I heard from the mom of a trans kid that if this bill passed, her child was going to kill themselves, said Willow Breshears, an 18-year-old community organizer at Little Rock Center for Artistic Revolution and the founder of the Young Trans Women's Project, who is trans herself. That's the reality, the kind of environment that we live in Arkansas. Stories like this now proliferate across the U.S. The CDC's latest Youth Risk Behavior Survey, released in 2019, estimated that about 2% of U.S. high schoolers identify as trans, or roughly 300,000 teens across the country. The figure does not count students not enrolled in high school or those unsure of their gender identity. 35% of surveyed trans students attempted suicide in prior year. There is a panic, and there's been rising desperation, says X Freelon, executive director of Lucy's Place, a homeless shelter and resource center for LGBTQ plus young adults. Freelon says such legislation and the rhetoric it represents will embolden those who reject trans and queer lives. Organizers like Breshears and Freelon in every state are battling powerful right-wing groups like the Family Research Council and rampant misinformation. Conservative campaigns claim that trans health care is dangerous and irreversible. In fact, gender affirmation care for most minors entails things like counseling and puberty suppressants, which give a child time to make gender identity choices and are reversible. Hormones can be an option as a teen ages. These treatments have been around for decades and are proven safe. Many clinicians have spoken out against the legislation and its potential for criminalizing evidence-based health care. And the National Collegiate Athletic Association has announced it will hold college championships only in states where trans students can participate. This means Texas, with 6 anti-trans bills on the docket, could be impacted. So could Florida, Mississippi, and Arizona. The bills vary by target and success. In Idaho, an anti-trans sports bill that passed in 2020 remains unimplemented after a legal challenge was upheld. In South Carolina, an anti-trans sports bill failed in committee in mid-March, while in South Dakota, after the state's bill became tied up in a legislative back and forth, Governor Kristi Noem issued 2 executive orders that effectively bar trans girls from participating in girls' sports. In North Carolina, a bill prohibiting gender-affirming surgeries for minors seems unlikely to succeed, thanks to the state's Democratic governor. But at the national level, the Equality Act, which would amend 1964's Civil Rights Act to include federal protections against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, still faces stiff opposition from Republicans in the U.S. Senate. I will do whatever I need to do to make sure he gets what he needs, Joanna Brandt says of Dylan's care. She would prefer not to have to consider what she calls Plan B, uprooting to a state where treatment's available. But they are running out of options. For now, the Brants and many families like them are just focused on getting through the rest of the school year. Dylan's looking forward to returning to school in person next fall. With luck, they will still be in Arkansas. There's a photo here of Dylan Brant. It looks like he's standing in the snow, wearing dark pants, dark shoes that are partially snow-covered, a gray hoodie and a black cap, and leaning against some metal edifice. It's perhaps a prefab building or a trailer. There's a fence in the background and some dense, dark trees beyond that. Postcard. At the front with Ukraine's president, by Simon Schuster, Shumi, Ukraine. They want us to be afraid, Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, says as his plane starts to descend, bringing him home from a trip to the war zone near his country's border with Russia. He's referring to the Russian troops who have massed along that border during the past 2 weeks, forcing the world to guess at the intentions of President Vladimir Putin. Is it a show of force, a sign of an imminent invasion, or a test of resolve for Ukraine and its allies? Zelensky has his own read on the Russian message. They want the West to be frightened of Russia's strength, of her power, he tells Time in an interview April 9. There's no big secret here. That motive might help explain some of Moscow's behavior. Had the Kremlin really set out to invade its neighbor, its troops might have tried a little harder, as they did during their 2014 invasion of Ukraine, to maintain some element of surprise. Instead, the Russians have done the opposite. They've spread footage of their military buildup on social media. They've sent warships to menace Ukraine from the sea and gathered tens of thousands of troops at the border, the most since Russia's annexation of Crimea 7 years ago. Russia's warned the U.S. that support for Ukraine could spiral into a wider conflict. On state television, a Kremlin propagandist even suggested launching a preemptive nuclear strike designed to scare the Americans off. But Zelensky, who entered politics only 2 years ago, after a long career as a comedian, does not appear to be buying the bluster. Russia's aim, he says, is to raise the temperature just enough to show the West will waver in its support for Ukraine, that they do not really see us as a partner. As Zelensky puts it, it's kind of a test. So far, the U.S. appears to be holding firm. In a response to the first military standoff of his tenure, President Joe Biden has pledged his unwavering support to Ukraine, including through military aid, which the U.S. announced in March. Biden reiterated the message during a call with Putin April 13, according to a White House statement. Zelensky and his government would like to see more support, especially high-end weapons. During a call with the Secretary General of NATO, Zelensky urged the alliance to give Ukraine a clearer path to membership. But to his own nation, the president seems focused on projecting a sense of calm. His trip to the East was a case in point. On the morning of April 8, Zelensky boarded a rickety Antonov plane and flew to the edge of the war zone with a coterie of generals, some of whom looked more nervous than their commander-in-chief. Among their first stops was a military outpost near the village of Shumi, a cluster of cabins and potato patches, where the current hostilities began March 26 with a volley of shots from a sniper rifle that left three Ukrainian soldiers dead beside their trenches. There was no tactical reason to attack that post, says General Ruslan Komchak, commander of Ukraine's armed forces. They just shot those boys in cold blood. Standing beside the trenches in a bulletproof vest, Zelensky did not promise to avenge their deaths. Instead, he questioned the wisdom of taking that ground in the first place, which Ukraine did with an assault against the Russian-backed positions in 2018, the year before Zelensky was elected. For some, that meant we were the tough guys, he says, glancing around at the field of shrubs. For others, it meant their sons would not be coming home. Zelensky does not intend to make such trades again. The risks are too high. Putin still could decide to mount a full-scale invasion, one that Ukraine would have little chance of resisting. And that is frightening, Zelensky admits, but he's trying not to show it. This has additional reporting by Madeline Roach, London, in addition to that of Simon Schuster, Shumi, Ukraine. There is a photo here. It's all in shades of browns and camouflage, green and brown and tan, and shows Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine, meeting with soldiers stationed on the Ukraine-Russia border, April 8. Like the others, Zelensky is dressed in a dark gray uniform with a camouflage vest, camouflage helmet, and face mask. He is not shown to be carrying any weapon, but the other soldiers surrounding him are. Milestones announced homecoming. U.S. troops to exit Afghanistan. By naming September 11, 2021 as the date that all U.S. troops will be out of Afghanistan, President Joe Biden reminded the world why they were there in the first place, to avenge the 9/11 terrorist attacks that had been planned in the country by Al-Qaeda, which the ruling Taliban regarded as a guest. There were a lot of distractions, like Iraq, which had no role in 9/11, although the U.S. invasion spawned a new terrorist threat, ISIS. There was also altruism. Most of the $2 trillion spent on Afghanistan aimed to transform a country that had barred girls from school. Brown University, which keeps count, reports that the 157,000 people killed there over the 20 years include 2,300 U.S. troops, 3,800 U.S. contractors, and 43,000 Afghan civilians. The highest toll, 64,000, is among the official Afghan forces. When the U.S. leaves, they must carry on the fight against a Taliban that, while it claims to have severed ties with Al-Qaeda, is again gaining ground. And that short item was written by Carl Vick. Died DMX, redemptive hip-hop icon. In early 1998, Puff Daddy and Bad Boy Records ruled hip-hop with Lush production and silk Versace suits. Then 27-year-old Earl Simmons, better known as DMX, released his debut album, It's Dark and Hell is Hot, and everything changed. The album, full of violent nihilism and hair-raising tales of betrayal and revenge, immediately skyrocketed to the top of the charts as songs like Puff Rider's Anthem rang out of car stereos across New York City and beyond. It was a complete 180, the Apple Music radio show host Loki tells Time. Here comes this crazy, energetic figure from Yonkers with the Timbs and the bandanas, running around with pit bulls, giving a perspective on the streets that a lot of people were not familiar with, and taking command of what hip-hop did not look like. By abrasively challenging the slickness of rap's assimilation into the mainstream, DMX, who died April 9 at 50, a week after suffering a heart attack, had unwittingly become one of the biggest rappers in the world. And over the next two decades, his raspy delivery and streetwise storytelling would have an outsized impact on the genre and its listeners. DMX's road to stardom was brutally difficult. He survived years of childhood abuse, homelessness, and prison stints. In his music, he fearlessly animated those traumas, giving voice to the countless Americans suffering from poverty, PTSD, or bipolar disorder. But DMX also wrote prayers for redemption as well as spirited anthems that would hypercharge clubs around the world, from X gon' give it to ya to party up. This versatility would make him a beacon for future generations of artists. He's recently been sampled or quoted by Drake, by ASAP Rocky, and even in Hamilton. And in 2012, Kendrick Lamar wrote a song paying respects to a record that changed his life. Thank God for the album I idolized, It's Dark, and Plus Hell is Hot. That's the start of this crazy ride. That article was written by Andrew R. Chow. An additional column here from Milestones, died. Bernie Madoff, who in 2009 was sentenced to 150 years in prison for running the largest Ponzi scheme in history, April 14 at 82. And as an editorial note, that was in the Butner Federal Corrections Facility in North Carolina. Seized the Ever Given, April 13, by Egypt, which claims the ship cost the country nearly $1 billion when it blocked the Suez Canal for 6 days. Recorded an all-time monthly high of nearly 19,000 unaccompanied migrant children at the U.S.-Mexico border in March 2021, U.S. authorities said April 8. Extended, Somalia's President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed's term by his own order, April 14. Restored, $235 million of U.S. aid to Palestinians that was cut under President Donald Trump, U.S. officials said, April 7. Won the Masters, April 11, by Hideki Matsuyama, the first Asian-born man to win the golf tournament. Stolen, Darius, the world's longest rabbit, from his owner's home in England the night of April 10. And again, under the brief Milestones, Prince Philip, The Queen's Man, by Howard Chua Aeon. There's a photo here in black and white. It covers 1 1/3 pages, or most of 1 1/3 pages. It shows Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip attending the 100th running of the Queen's Plate horse race in Toronto, June 30, 1959. It appears they are riding in an open carriage. It's a close-up of the Queen and the Prince. In the background, there is a stadium with 1, 2, 3, 4 tiers of spectators pretty much crammed in. This, again, was in 1959. The Queen's in the foreground, closest to the camera's lens. The photo is in black and white, but she's wearing a light-colored outfit. One sees only her shoulders and head. The always present pearl earrings. She's wearing what is probably white or a very, very light colored hat. It looks feathery, but I don't think it's feathers. I think it's fabric that's been etched and sewn to look like feathers. Prince Philip is looking askance, actually, over the Queen's shoulder, a little bit toward the camera. Dapper as always, wearing a medium-colored suit. Perhaps it's blue or gray or tan. He's wearing a tie, which he's holding with his left hand, as if he's straightening it for the camera. And he's smiling slightly. Prince Philip, the Queen's man, until her father's health began deteriorating, the couple could have been mistaken for any other happy young husband and wife. She had been just 13 when they met. He was the striking, handsome 18-year-old guide who took her and her sister on a tour of his naval college. During the war, when he was on a battleship in the Mediterranean, she kept his photograph on her dressing table, even though her father did not quite approve. They had a spectacular wedding and had had 2 children by the time they were traveling in Africa and got the news. Her father, King George VI, had died. At age 25, she had succeeded to the British throne as Elizabeth II. Everything also changed for her husband. The man who was with the couple recalled the transformation that took place February 6, 1952. Speaking to British newspaper The Independent, he said of the succession, "She seemed almost to reach out for it. There were no tears. She was just there, back braced, waiting for her destiny." Her husband, by contrast, sat almost crumpled behind his newspaper. He did not want it at all. It was going to change his whole life, take away the emotional stability he had finally found. But by the time of his death, April 9, at 99, Philip had long ago surpassed the record for a man with the title of consort. The closest was Philip and Elizabeth's common great-great-grandfather Albert, Prince Consort to Queen Victoria, during their 21 years of marriage. Philip, who received the title of Duke of Edinburgh upon marrying Elizabeth in 1947, would, before retiring from public engagements in the summer of 2017, perform royal duties for 7 decades. Through scandals and flamboyant in-laws, with just enough audible grousing from him now and then to make everyone remember what a strange business it all was. If anyone was a princely pauper, it was Philip, Schleswig-Holstein-Sonderburg-Glücksburg, born in 1921 atop a kitchen table on the island of Corfu. His father was the 7th son of a Danish prince plucked out of Scandinavia to become king of Greece. His mother was a Battenberg, a British family of German origin that had changed its last name to Mountbatten during World War I, about the same time the British royal family became the Windsors instead of the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas. His parents' marriage ended when Philip was 10 years old. Raising her 4 daughters and young son by dint of loans, limited family legacies, and hand-me-downs, Alice of Greece would eventually find solace in religion and become a nun. At the end of her life, she lived in Buckingham Palace, walking the halls in her wimple. Her daughters would seek their fortunes in marriages in distant places. Philip was shuttled from country to country. From Greece, the family moved to Paris. When his parents split, he ended up in England for a couple of years and then was taken in by German relatives. The unanchored life bred insecurity into the young noble. He found a harbor in Gordonston, a public school set up in Scotland. Gordonston's combination of pacificism and physical discipline would help define Philip for the rest of his life. His pursuit of what might have been a lifelong career in the Royal Navy was propelled by its tenets. But then he met Princess Elizabeth, the heiress presumptive to the throne, or Lilibet, as she was then known. And while George VI may have looked askance at a Greek Orthodox royal from the wrong side of the blue-blooded track, his daughter could not be argued into considering any other match. The dynasty's last crisis was a matter of the heart. George VI's brother, Edward, had abdicated in order to marry a divorcee, an impermissible entanglement for the head of the Church of England. In Elizabeth's case, the solution was simple. Philip gave up Greek Orthodoxy and was accepted into the Anglican Communion. They were married November 20, 1947. She was 21, he was 26. Being consort to the British sovereign may have been more difficult than any feat demanded by Gordonston. Philip was always one step behind Elizabeth, always deferring to her in public. But Philip's reported insistence on leaving his own mark may have led to a post-coronation rupture in their relationship behind palace doors. At one point, he proposed changing the family's last name to include his own, but his wife would not hear of it. Furious, Philip reportedly said, "I'm just a bloody amoeba, that's all." The Duke would always be sensitive about his role. Asked about it once by the BBC, he said, "Constitutionally, I don't exist." Philip was always publicly loyal to his wife, evidenced by his immense amount of appearances and charity work. His faithfulness was another issue, with rumors dogging him throughout his public life. He also disliked her corgis. But Philip and Elizabeth did exude a palpable affection when they were seen in public together. In unguarded moments, the usually austere queen was, in the word of one observer, kittenish when interacting with her husband. Celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary in 1997, Elizabeth called him my strength and stay all these years, adding I and his whole family in this and many other countries owe him a debt greater than he would ever claim. To almost everyone, she is the queen, except for her children, to whom she is mummy. Even when Philip spoke of his wife to others, he would refer to her by her title. But when they spoke to each other, he still called her Lilibet, that ancient term of endearment from the early years of marriage, before she ascended the throne. In a 1992 interview with the journalist Fiammetta Rocco, he offered an unfinished, yet poignant, sentence. People forget what it was like when the Queen was 26 and I was 30 when she succeeded. Well, that's when things started. Or perhaps when they ended. The brief news. Good question. Why did the U.S. pause vaccinations with J&J shots? Both the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, recommended April 13 that vaccinations with Johnson & Johnson's Janssen COVID-19 vaccine be temporarily halted while the agencies review 6 reports of blood clots among vaccinated people. J&J has also proactively suspended vaccinations in Europe as it reviews these cases. Blood clots linked to COVID-19 vaccines are a growing concern after reports in Europe linked to another vaccine from AstraZeneca, designed in a similar way, led UK health officials in early April to advise that younger people use different shots. While the U.S. recommendation is not a mandate to stop using the vaccine, local officials quickly followed the federal advice. Some are swapping in either of the two-dose vaccines from Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna, which have not been linked to such clotting events for those who have been scheduled to get the J&J shot. Still, it could slow vaccination, especially in under-resourced communities where public health officials had been relying on the J&J shot since it requires only one dose and can be stored at refrigerated, not frozen, temperatures. The CDC is convening a special advisory committee to review the cases and is expected to provide more guidance soon. Both the CDC and FDA have stressed that the side effect is rare. 6 reports among nearly 7 million people vaccinated with the J&J shot in the U.S. so far. But they decided to pause immunization so doctors could learn how to recognize and properly treat the clots. Very few recently vaccinated people appear to generate an allergic-type reaction that stimulates their blood clotting factors and immune cells, including antibodies directed against the blood clotting factors, to aggregate, blocking blood flow. The clotting mirrors, a rare condition triggered by the blood thinner heparin, which normally prevents clots but in unusual cases has the opposite effect and prompts immune cells to form clots instead. So in these cases, as with the vaccine-induced clots, doctors should use blood thinners other than heparin or immune globulin therapy. If you have been vaccinated with the J&J shot, and it's been over a month, you are probably not going to have clotting problems, since most occur between 5 to 14 days after vaccination. But if you have recently received the shot, be aware of symptoms like headaches, abdominal or leg pain, or shortness of breath, and report them to your doctor. That article was by Alice Park. Finance, paying tribute. The UK recently unveiled a £50 banknote featuring mathematician Alan Turing, who cracked a Nazi code during World War II, but was later prosecuted for being gay. Here, other countries honoring previously persecuted figures on their currencies. This short item is by Madeline Roach. activist honored. Civil rights activist Viola Desmond, arrested for refusing to leave the whites-only section of a Canada theater in 1946, was chosen for the country's $10 bill in 2018, the first Canadian woman to appear on currency. Bill reversed. After Saddam Hussein's ouster in 2003, Iraq's leaders removed his image from currency and instead issued 25,000 dinar bills picturing a Kurdish farmer to represent the people Hussein had oppressed. None checked, and that's N-U-N, checked. Since 1978, 17th century nun and poet Sor Juana Inez de la Cruz, whose feminist views caused controversy in her lifetime, has been featured on several Mexican banknotes. Her poem, Foolish Men, has also appeared on the 200 peso note. News ticker, three short articles here. Sabotage at Iran nuke facility. Iran described a blackout and apparent explosion at an atomic facility in the city of Natanz, April 11, as an act of nuclear terrorism. The U.S. has denied involvement, with suspicions pointed toward Israel as tensions mount between the two Middle East nations. Biden calls for gun law reforms, calling U.S. gun violence an epidemic. President Joe Biden announced new executive actions on gun violence, April 7. They include proposed rules to stop the spread of ghost guns that can be assembled from kits and publishing red flag legislation for states to model. India facing drastic COVID-19 surge. With 13.5 million confirmed as of April 12, India became the country with the world's second highest number of COVID-19 cases amid a new wave. Experts argue incomplete testing suggests the real total is likely higher than that of the U.S., which currently has the most confirmed cases worldwide. This short article is under the heading Nation, American Crucible. It's written by Janelle Ross, Minneapolis. It's become an American routine, a sudden death followed by public displays of grief and protest and a sorting of two distant camps. Some will call the death an egregious extrajudicial killing, statistically unlikely to be redressed. To others, almost without exception, it's justifiable homicide. The machinery of justice is once again asked how to respond when police officers end civilian lives, a disproportionate share of which are black. But this week in Metro Minneapolis, a rare police trial connected to one black man's death could not conclude before another died. In Brooklyn Center, a diverse bedroom community of about 31,000, about 10 miles north of Minneapolis, the April 11 shooting of Dante Wright, 20, by Kim Potter, a white police officer who since resigned, set off protests in both cities, as well as some property damage and looting. The National Guard, state and local law enforcement, equipped with guns, batons, tear gas, rubber bullets, and flashbangs, have since been dispatched to restore what is known as order. And each morning in downtown Minneapolis, Derek Chauvin, a white former police officer who in May 2020 used his knee to pin down another black man, George Floyd, for over 9 minutes, is on trial inside a courthouse encircled by concrete boundaries, chain-link fencing, and citizen soldiers dressed for war. Floyd's death was ruled a homicide. On April 14, county prosecutors confirmed their plans to file second-degree manslaughter charges against Potter. The day after Chauvin's trial, judge said the case will likely go to jury next week, meaning this week. In the interim, the metro region awakes to an expectant tension, as irritating as the whiffs of tear gas that in some places remain. Time Off Books, the feature, The Radical Honesty of Celebrity Memoirs by Katie Lang. Sharon Stone wants you to know that she is a survivor, and it would be easy to assume her new memoir, The Beauty of Living Twice, draws its title from its opening passage, which describes her 2001 hospitalization after suffering a brain hemorrhage and stroke that left her with a 1% chance of survival. But the book contains an entire lifetime marked by beating the odds. Stone details miraculously surviving near decapitation, being struck by lightning and walking away from her totaled car after skidding on black ice. The most compelling passages, however, are the clear-eyed and at times brutally honest recollections of how she has persevered in the wake of trauma, inflicted not by nature or accident, but by other people, ranging from the physical and sexual abuse she experienced as a child to the many ways her consent has been undermined at work and beyond. In spite of Stone's 4 decades in the industry, The Beauty of Living Twice is far from the glitzy account of Hollywood that readers might expect. Instead, it shows a woman who spent the majority of her years in the public eye, seizing the opportunity to tell her story entirely on her own terms. And Stone is not alone. Her book is one of a handful of recent celebrity memoirs that are refreshingly rich counterparts to the more traditional, glossy offerings of the genre. Celebrities have long tended to treat publishing so-called tell-alls as a means to revive a fading career, reach fans in a new way, or simply develop another revenue stream, all while staying within the bounds of delivering flattering self-portraits and a few carefully considered personal revelations designed to spark media attention. But a new group of mega-famous women have recently set their intentions on a new goal, writing truly compelling books. From Stone's new release to Jessica Simpson's delightfully sincere open book, Mariah Carey's witty and revealing The Meaning of Mariah Carey, and Demi Moore's unflinchingly raw Inside Out, the new era of celebrity memoirs is defined by no-holds-barred honesty. One way to explain this shift is fairly simple. The move toward unfiltered storytelling tracks with the dominance of social media, a tool that has undeniably transformed the celebrity landscape. Gone are the days of the inaccessible, mysterious A-lister of the tabloid era, whose public perception was determined largely by the whims of paparazzi. Now, with platforms like Instagram, access to public figures and the inner workings of their lives are just a screen swipe away and firmly within their control, making authenticity, or at least the performance of it, the key to attracting a loyal audience. Danny Pellegrino, host of the popular pop culture podcast Everything Iconic, draws a straight line between the accessibility of celebrities on social media and their understanding of the need to be more forthcoming on the page. We cannot just get the usual fluff like we could back in the 90s or early 2000s, he says. We just know too much. This shift also comes at a crucial moment of reckoning with the destructive consequences of early aughts tabloid culture and its relentless scrutiny, and particularly a re-evaluation of the misogynistic narratives spun around women during this time. Recent documentaries about Britney Spears and Paris Hilton show just how much damage constant and oftentimes cruel media coverage caused them as they were coming of age. Meanwhile, the people who reinforced toxic narratives about young women in public may have begun reflecting on their complicity. Following the release of the Spears doc, Justin Timberlake wrote a public apology to both Spears, who was blamed for their 2002 breakup, and Janet Jackson, who was scapegoated after their infamous 2004 Super Bowl halftime performance. It is telling that Simpson, whose career as a singer was often overshadowed by gossipy, belittling narratives, found resounding success last year with her earnest and entrancing memoir. Readers eagerly ate up her candid revelations, no names withheld, about what she experienced on the other side of the coverage that perpetually made punch lines out of her persona, her love life, and her body. By sharing her side of the story, Simpson rewrote her legacy in pop culture, raising essential questions about the ways in which, as a society, we have both constructed and consumed women in the spotlight. One of the most apt examples of this approach to taking back control of the narrative, and an early example of this rising trend, may be Demi Moore's 2019 memoir, Inside Out. The prototype of an A-lister during the tabloid era, the actor was committed to laying bare even the most painful moments of her life in service of telling her full story, making for a read that was not only compelling but also nuanced in its bracing honesty. To write her book, Moore re-examined the headline-making parts of her career, like once being the highest-paid female actor in Hollywood, and her highly scrutinized relationships with Bruce Willis and Ashton Kutcher. But she also explored intensely private aspects of her history, her turbulent childhood, her parents' substance abuse, a heartbreaking miscarriage, her own off-and-on struggle with addiction. If I really wanted to be authentic, I needed to share my real experience, Moore tells Time. To do that kind of glossy version would have cheated me out of the really cathartic and healing experience that it was. This new approach to celebrity memoirs extends to the writing process itself. Ghostwriters, typically the faceless forces behind many books by famous non-writers, are now becoming more visible, with celebrities openly teaming up with high-profile professionals. It is a move that aligns with the hunger for realness from the people whose images appear on the book's covers. Pellegrino, a celebrity ghostwriter himself who worked with reality television stars Ariana Madix and Tom Sandoval on their book, encourages that candor. It is best when a celebrity is honest and open about who they're working with for their memoirs, he says. The audience knows that. It just helps the celebrity seem more authentic. Optics aside, a good collaborator can also elevate a project. Although Mariah Carey is notable for her prolific songwriting, she turned to veteran editor and writer Michaela Angela Davis for helping with crafting her 2020 book, The Meaning of Mariah Carey. The choice was fitting. Who better to co-write a memoir that explored Carey's racial identity and time in the music industry than Davis, a former editor for Essence and Vibe? The result was a book that effortlessly channeled both Carey's balladic songwriting style and her trademark humor in telling the story of how a chaotic childhood helped shape the superstar. Likewise, Moore reached out to Ariel Levy, a journalist at The New Yorker, to work on Inside Out, noting that because she wanted to ensure her memoir would be a good book, she wanted a collaborator with experience, that Levy had also lost a pregnancy, which she wrote about in her own 2017 memoir, The Rules Do Not Apply, provided a point of deep connection and trust for the pair, both of whom consider the book to be a true collaboration. For Levy, Moore's opportunity to reclaim the narrative was one of the highlights of the work. Anybody who's had a public persona knows that they're not in charge of it, Levy says. But with this story, she was calling the shots. It was thrilling to work on it with her because she knew it was her story. She was really brave and really went there. That sentiment gets at the heart of why this new crop of books has resonated with both those who are pop culture obsessed and those who are simply in it for a good read. The appeal lies not in tabloid-style nuggets of gossip, but rather within the wholly relatable power of sharing your story on your own terms. The four books referred to in this article are Mariah Carey's Meaning of Mariah Carey, Jessica Simpson's Open Book, Sharon Stone's The Beauty of Living Twice, and Demi Moore's Inside Out. Each of these book cover jackets shows a photograph of the subjects of the books. From Time Off Opener Movies, The Year the Oscars Came Down to Earth by Stephanie Zakarik, I'm going to read to you just the captions of four photographs depicted on these two pages. The top one, and these are all in color and they're not very large. Alexander Nanow's Collective is nominated for Best Documentary Feature and Best International Feature. It shows a man standing at a microphone, perhaps at a press conference. Below that, Frances McDormand in Chloe Zhao's Best Picture Contender, Nomadland, nominated in several categories. McDormand is seen here in an outdoor setting. It's very blurry. She's dressed in dark clothing. The background is dark, and she's leaning on a fence or a rail holding a cigarette. The late Chadwick Boseman earned a Best Actor nomination for his role in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, a young man seated with his back against an old upright piano, and Lee Isaac Chung's Minari, M-I-N-A-R-I, has nominations in several categories, including Best Picture. This scene depicts five individuals in an Asian family. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, and I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5177.